Welcome to Headlines. This is David Lichtenstein. This week we have an interesting show. We will have two guests, Rabbi Yehuda David Bleich, Rosh Yeshiva of Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, mechaber of numerous svarim. He'll be speaking about fertility issues. He's one of the world's, one of the world's great paiskim on fertility issues. And he will be speaking also about the recent New York City court decision for fines of up to $250,000 of somebody who arrests or doesn't otherwise accommodate somebody with a transgender background. We will ask him about halachically, what is the status of transgender? We will also have Rabbi Yeshua Berman, who's the director of Mayanot in Beit Shemesh, one-of-a-kind center. That will be a little bit of a discussion continuing last week's discussion. Now, last week I got a lot of emails, a lot from victims who basically were telling me about the different threats that they've had from other predators, both financial and otherwise, and a number of somewhat critical emails as well, and I'm going to read this one. This is from Yosef Rones. Dear Mr. Lichtenstein, I've been listening to your program for a while and have generally found it to be enjoyable and informative. Thank you, Yosef. However, I recently upset to listen to the program this past Matzah Shabbos, Parshas Lech Lecha. Your program is supposed to be a halacha program. I don't understand why you thought it was appropriate to have someone describe abuse he suffered in graphic detail in a non-sneous way. I found it too offensive. How many young Bachrim listen to this program? Do they need to be exposed to this? Of course, this is an important topic, but everything has its place and time, an appropriate way of giving it over. To top it off, you've even included in this person's accusation of someone, which I don't know if it's true or not, but it probably is blatant Lashon Hara, which you spread to all the listeners. And I imagine he's speaking about Rabbi Margolis and Rabbi Coco. You announced before your program about open orthodoxy with Alpidas Torah. Is this one too? I await your response. That's basically his letter. And I skipped a few words here and there. So I'd like to respond to that. I think these are very valuable points, and I appreciate feedback. And your first question is it a halacha program? And the answer is yes. But, you know, the word halacha, we say every day in Davin, Al tikri halicha, kol hashayna halachos b'chol yom, how do you know? It's in where it says, because you say, Alt tikri halichais ela halachais. Halichais oilam lai. The Gemara says, Alt tikri halichais. Halichais means pathways. Alt tikri halichais ela halachais. So halachais comes from halichais, pathways, rotes. You know, halacha is about living in this life. It's about halichais. It's about guiding people, guiding children, guiding ourselves, educating ourselves. So the Rabbeinu Shalom didn't give the Dalit Chalkei Shulchan Aruch that they should stay up on a shelf all dusty. They're supposed to be actuated, integrated, become an effectuated part of our life. So when we have people speaking about Tzvi Gluck, about the suicides, the 100 or so suicides a year, most of which he believes have to do with, you know, molestation. I thought it's important. Let's listen to somebody who went through it. And that's halicha yisraelim, halacha, halicha. Bring the halacha into our life. Make it real. And also gives us as a community the opportunity to learn what it means, leisamo del dam riecha, when we hear the pain of such a person and how it affected them. Hashavas Aveda, Hashavas Haguf is even greater than Hashavas Aveda, the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, I think it's on Dafayin Beis, that zip code. So I think halacha is not divorced from reality. It's not something that's supposed to say in shul or yeshiva. We're supposed to bring it here, and that's what I'm very proud to do. It's something. Now, Bachrim listening to this will find it offensive and unsneistic. Well, there's only one thing worse than that, if they haven't heard it, and it happens to them in a very non-steistic way because nobody explained to them graphically what these people do. So better they hear it here than they, Rahman al-Islam, find out firsthand. Now the last point was about Rabbi Margolis and Rabbi Coco. You know, Lashon Hara that is not used, if you can save somebody, right, and you don't, you're not anymore a Shomer Lashon Hara, but anything you could have been Mekayim by being, you've lost by not speaking out when you're supposed to. You know, there's a Hagoyetz Maimonis in Ochel Chanukah. He says, if somebody gives a large amount of money to tzedakah, I heard this from a putna, Zohar Lebracha, once, and then he says, and then he loses it the next day playing cards, he says, the schar mashakibol bezeh ibid bezeh. And the idea is, because it doesn't mean you're a bal tzedakah, it just means you're a spendthrift. If somebody doesn't speak Lashon Hara, and then they have the opportunity to save somebody and they don't speak up, they lost the schar of shmiras halashon, because it's not that they're shaymer lashon, it just means they don't know how to use their tongue. We have to know when to speak and when not to speak. When somebody asks a shidduch, and they're speaking about somebody who's rachmana litzlan, a drug addict, a gambler, can't have children, and they say, we're not going to speak Lashon Hara, any schar that they ever got for shmiras halashon, according to Hagoyetz Maimonis, they lost. So I say Lashon Hara, if it's L'tayelis, the Mishneh Berurah, the Chafetz Chaim in the Sif Yud, in Klal Yud of Shmiras Lashon, says you're mechuyev to say it. So you could say Rabbi Koka, what is Rabbi Margolis involved? Well, you know, I'll say something that'll probably get me in trouble with a lot of people. You know, that Penn State had a molestation issue. A boy was molested by the football coach. Penn State was a college with tens of thousands of people, and it's a city called Penn State, Pennsylvania. The entire city lives off this college. And you know what the people, the government and was decided? They threw the entire faculty out. Anybody who could have known, should have known, who kept their mouth quiet was thrown out. They were fined. They lost 10 years of their titles. It was a national championship. School was very famous for a football team. It was one of the most famous in the country. They stripped them of 10 years of titles. They basically didn't allow them to draft or pay competitively for the next 10 years. They shut an entire city down because of an hullah that was quiet about molestation. So I ask you a question. We know there's a klal, the Gemara uses it in many places, miyaka midi. Klal Yisrael is supposed to be at a high level. If the state sees that to protect children, we throw out an entire anhala, should we as a Klal Yisrael, right, or la'amim, should we love our children less? You know, there's a Magen Avraham. Again, I don't have a Magen Avraham in front of me. It's like Reish Mem Dalad. He says a halacha that even though you're allowed to build, I believe I mentioned it here before, but he says, even though you're allowed to halachically build chutz v'tchum, when you didn't give the contract on Shabbos, directions to build on Shabbos, he's doing it out of his own volition. But he says, a shul you can't build. He says, because the Umay Sa'ilim will say, we don't build our Batei Tefillah, our base of Avodah Zarah, on our Shabbos. How could they build it on theirs? So even though it's halachically mutter, it should never be said that the Torah has made us less authentic, less diligent, less moral than any other ummah. So when the Goyim go ahead and they say, anybody who was in the administration who should have, could have, would have known was thrown out, how come in our schools, when there's a molester who's been there for 30 years, a fantastic yeshiva, by the way, my nephews went there, one of the great yeshivas, how do the parents of such a yeshiva tolerate that they should treat their children worse than the students of Penn State? Don't we love our children? So I'm not, I don't have an answer. I ask you, my audience, do we love our children? Should our standards be lower than the people who live in Penn State, Pennsylvania? So that's why I felt it was both Lashon Hara L'Tayelis. And additionally, do you really want to have your children educated by Anhala that was really quiet at the switch and turned the other way for so many years? So that's my answer to Yosef Ronis. I don't know if he will accept it, but I try to, you know, say what I believe here. And anybody who disagrees is welcome to send me their comments to info@headlinesbook.com, and I will, of course, choose but appropriate responses I will read on the air. So let's go to our fantastic guests. I was going to say something about the Parsha, but we're sort of out of time. So let's go to our fantastic guests. Let's welcome Rabbi Bleich. The honor of having with us Hagoyin Rabbi Yehuda David Bleich, Rosh Yeshiva in Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan. He's a musmach of Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Mendel Zaks, a Talmud of Rabbi Elia Chazan. He's a mechaber of so many svarim, too numerous to actually say here on the air. And he has the unique honor, I believe I saw this once, in one of the Igros Moshe's Chuvis, he calls to him Yedidi, or of Yehuda David Bleich. And I know nobody else that I personally know of alive today who Rav Moshe Feinstein has given the honor of Yedidi. It's a great honor to have you with us, Rabbi Bleich.
Thank you very much. That today you wanted me to talk about transgender issues, sex change operations, which is now the latest series, presents the latest series of problems in terms of halacha. And we're dealing with
executive order that every school in the United States right now is supposed to have a transgender bathroom. So this has become a very big, you know, topic in the news. Halachically, is there any status of transgender?
The question of the status of the transgender is very much a topical issue in society at large. There are a number of issues involved. The question is, what is the approach to transgenderism in general? And secondly, what do you do when you're confronted with a person who is in this category of transgender? And finally, if you undergo certain medical procedures, what is the status of that person in halacha? Now, it's necessary, the issue in terms of transgender, as the term is used, and I'll use that term rather than intergender, you have individuals who are born with all the indications of one gender, both external and primary and secondary sexual characteristics of those of one gender, but the individual feels that he is a member of the other gender. He feels, for example, that he is a woman but trapped in the body of a man, or vice versa. One contemporary writer, the author of a monograph called Dor Tapuches, has described this as the nefesh of a nekeva that occupies the body of a zohar, or vice versa. Now, I consider that description a little bit piquant, but yes, he is absolutely right. He is describing in terms that we use in halacha and in hashkofe, he is describing a phenomenon that medicine describes in an entirely parallel way. A psychiatrist would say that in terms of this individual psyche, this person is a female, the body is that of a male. And you've got to remember that the English psyche is derived from the Greek psuche, and the Greek psuche is the Greek word for soul. So yes, you've got the soul or the psyche of a female trapped in the body of a male, or vice versa. I would rephrase that by saying you have a person who is physically a male and feels, for whatever reason, that he is not a male, but he's a female. I would call that a mental aberration, subtype of disorder. Now, there is a volume called Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Medical Disorders, DSM for short. It's now in its fifth edition. It's a manual used by psychiatrists for purposes of diagnosis. Remember that you can be reimbursed for medical expenses only if the baby has a name. You have to have a diagnosis of a mental disorder. So transgenderism was previously diagnosed as a mental disorder, as once upon a time was homosexuality. It's now probably 40 years or so since homosexuality was removed from the list of mental disorders. The transgenderism was in the list of mental disorders as a form of gender identity disorder, GID. In the most recent manual, the phraseology has been changed to gender dysphoria instead of disorder. It's the same, only it's a more neutral term. The purpose of the change was to remove stigma that is attached to the term disorder. But one has to remember that this is still recorded as a diagnosable condition and hence a treatable condition. What the treatment is, we can talk about a little bit later. But the purpose of undergoing sex change procedures is to alleviate the distress. A person who has no distress doesn't seek treatment. So to experience this, seek one of three things. Some of them are fairly happy just to identify with the other sex, to wear the clothing of the other sex, want people to think of them as being members of the other sex, and now it is generally accepted that they ought to be able to decide which pronoun they want to be referred to by, he or she. It may even be protected in the city of New York by a city ordinance. And that's why you have this business of the transgender bathrooms or the issue of which bathroom should they use. The individual is physically, anatomically, a member of one sex and wants to use the bathroom of another sex. And that becomes a significant social problem, if nothing else. The next step are the ones who aren't just simply happy to be accepted as a member of the opposite gender, but want to have the physical characteristics of the other gender. And the first procedure is hormone treatments, so that the at least secondary sexual characteristics can be modified. And then finally, there is transsexual surgery, in which there is an attempt to change the sex physically and anatomically. If somebody comes to ask the question, I have to answer that each one of these is prohibited. This person is, let us say, a male, but fancies himself a female and wishes to wear the clothing of a male. There's an Yisraeli Silva. She wants to wear the clothing of a male, identify himself as a female, and that is clearly the rationale underlying the Yisraeli Silva.
So let's say they come to Shul, that they sit in the Ezra's Nashim or the Ezra's Anashim.
That, I have had that Shiloh four times in the last 18 months. But let me explain, first of all, why I think that absolutely nothing has taken place.
And Rabbi Bleich, let me just interrupt. I just want to reference to the Olam, who may not be aware of it. There is a most surprising tshuva, the Tzitz Eliezer, who is certainly a very great Pesach, with prejudice. He was a first cousin of mine once removed. The Tzitz Eliezer in Chelik Yud Simen Chaf Hei, Perik Chaf Vavav, that's Yud Chaf Hei Chaf Vavav, was asked, brings us from Reb Chaim Pelagia, who's a Friedrich, a Sfaradish Achren.
Yosef Pelagia.
Reb Yosef Pelagia, that's right, must be maybe a cousin of Reb Chaim Pelagia.
Probably.
He says, an Isha who turned into an Ish, he says, and she was married. He brings a case. He doesn't say how it occurred. He says, there was an Isha who was married to an Ish, and he turns into a male. We have to assume some type of a surgery. I don't know what they had back in, in the 1800s in Turkey. So he says he does not need a get, because since he is now a male, he says a male does not have to divorce a male. So we clearly understand that there is halachic significance to this. And the Tzitz Eliezer, I never heard of Rabbi Yosef Pelagia, but the Tzitz Eliezer was a leading Pesach in Eretz Yisrael. He's a big guy, and I'm sure you've used his Sfarim hundreds of times. Says this rather surprising psak, so I just want to throw this out there before you respond.
Let me analyze both the Tshuva and Chelek Yud. There are two other Tshuvas. There's one in Chelek Yud, there's one in Chelek Yud Aleph, and one in Chelek Chof Beis.
Yeah.
Let me talk about the one in Chelek Yud. The one in Chelek Yud is essentially a quotation from the Yad Nemon of which is cited by the Rabbi Yosef Pelagia, who quotes even earlier sources. What those sources are talking about are an individual who underwent some type of metamorphosis without benefit of surgery. There is no hint that there was any type of surgery. I will confess that when I first saw the Tshuva and the reference to the Yad Nehemon, I thought that we must be dealing with science fiction. And I'm indebted to Professor Edward Reichman, who is an expert in the history of medicine. He's on the faculty of Albert Einstein Medical School. He was kind enough to share with me a chapter in a book called Anomalies and Curiosities of Medicine, published in 1900. In one of the chapters in that book, I found a reference to a person whose name was Marie Madeleine Lefort, who as a young woman was believed to be a woman. She, to all intents and purposes, was a woman. She menstruated, although not in an entirely normal way, but there was menstruation. After she underwent menopause, and apparently it was at a rather early age, she suddenly turned into a male. Now, I don't know exactly what turning into a male means. I suspect that she was an androgynous of one kind or another, and that earlier in her life, the female hormones were predominant, which is what caused menstruation and caused a lot of other things. After menstruation, the endocrine balance changed, and the male hormones became predominant, and the sexual characteristics of the male became more pronounced. But the medical literature accepted the notion that you had a female, assuming that the facts are as given. We're told that there was a person who, to all intents and purposes, was a female. She married, and later she was diagnosed, shall I say, as being a male, and that's what we're dealing with in terms of she require a get. And there is a controversy cited in the Yad Nehemon. He thought that didn't require a get because she is no longer a woman. She's become a male. And among his arguments, he says the nusach of the get is ant antosi, you, my wife, my woman, and she is no longer a woman. And this is very similar to the Truma Sadeshin, as Rabbi Woldenberg points out, who was asked with regard to the wife of Eliyahu Hanavi.
Yeah, does she need a get?
Yep. Does she need a get? So the Truma Sadeshin says, Eishes for Eyu Omar Achmon, and not
Eishes Malach. Yeah.
She's not on your west.
Seminai Kuf Beis, yeah.
Yes, yes. Now, that's not the end of the story as far as Eishes Elio is concerned. Reb Elchanan has a different analysis of Eishes Elio. The question is whether you require Misa Sabal or a get as a matir, or if the absence of a husband means that there is no ongoing oser, as if matrimony is an ongoing process and is no longer a female to be married. Now, that's not the issue, but there was a disagreement cited in the original source. Another gentleman, his name was Elia Abulafia, I presume one of the Abulafia family, who took a different position. He says he wants to know what will happen if this same person who was originally female became a male. What if she becomes a male or a female all over again? The original Kedushin Chayza Venier, is she Osir, if she got married in between to the first husband because it was a woman who married somebody else, etc., etc. Now, that is the only case or the only source on record, and Rabbi Woldenberg does very little more than cite the source. Before I turn to the Tshuva of Rabbi Woldenberg, I will say that there is one other source, and that's a psalmim rosh, which is attributed to the rosh. The provenance of the manuscript is highly suspect, but we're talking about a male who underwent a sex change procedure, what we would call today. Basically, it was castration. And the issue is, can he contract a marriage, not an already married man? And the whole thrust of the psalmim rosh is that a eunuch
cannot contract a marriage. Now, that is novel. It's a chiddush gadol. And his argument is that, obvious reasons, so we know what marriage is all about. He is incapable of sexual performance, therefore he can't go marry. Then, the very last two lines, he says, but what if this happens after marriage? He says, it would seem that you could say that he doesn't have to give the wife a get anymore because she doesn't have a marriage. However, to say that this is a guf chodosh and that he is really like a woman, zekosh beinai in v'lav v'rof yabiyodi le'milani libi, he's not ready to go to the logical conclusion. Now, the Psamim Reish is talking about what we would call a sex change operation. And his bottom line is that if the person has been castrated, he can't contract a marriage as a male, but that if he is married, the wife requires a get. He is a little bit in doubt, but he certainly doesn't say she doesn't require a get. I am not at all intimating that Psamim Reish is Aloch Psuka, but if you have a person who has undergone the sex change operation and then doesn't want to contract the marriage as a female, he wants to contract the marriage as a male, this is squarely within the parameters of what the Psamim Reish is talking about. Rabbi Waldenberg in Chelek Yud is talking about things that happened naturally. There is no hint either in the Tzitz Eliezer or in the sources that he cite that we're talking about a surgical procedure to turn the male into, to turn the female into a male. I don't know how you do that. I do know what they do, but that's not a true sex change operation. And I'm certain that's not what they're talking about. Now, the second shuva, which is in Chelek Yud Aleph, is even more intriguing, frankly. There, we're dealing with a more common phenomenon, and it's really a more heart-wrenching phenomenon.
It's almost like an androgynous in a way, isn't it? Child who has both simanim, the one in Chelek Yud Aleph.
In Yud Aleph is what medicine would call ambiguous genitalia.
Yeah.
Now, a person who has a full complement of external sexual organs of both a male and a female is called a hermaphrodite in English. It's what we call an androgynous. A hermaphrodite has at least the external organs of both a male and a female. Medically, they use that for the description of the ones who have the internal organs as well. I'll focus on the external organs because I'm convinced, for purposes of halacha, that it's the external organs that are kiveya. They are the determinants rather than the internal organs. In the terms of an androgynous, you don't find any place that if you incise the abdomen and find either male or female organs, that is dispositive in determining whether the person is male or female. In the case of a tumtum, which has none of the external organs, the Gemara says that you're kireya, the beten, you incise the abdomen, and you look for the organs. I take it for granted that they mean you're looking for what otherwise would have been the external organs. Dr. Abraham S. Abraham expresses a little bit of doubt with regard to what you're looking for in the case of a tumtum. But that's not our problem because I'm not aware of any medical report of a tumtum. And as far as an androgynous is concerned, it seems to me that there is no discussion of an androgynous who has been subject to some kind of medical procedure, and you then take the internal organs into account. And Chazal never said that it was necessary to do so. So it seems to be that we're dealing with the external organs. Now, the question is, and believe it or not, in medicine, in terms of human anatomy, there can be children born, and it is very, very difficult to determine whether it's a male or a female. I will not go into all the anatomical details, but it's clear that a urologist will have difficulty making a determination. And it was this case of ambiguous genitalia that Rabbi Waldenberg discusses in Chelek Yud Aleph. Externally, Again, I'm not even talking about the chromosomes. The chromosomes don't play any significant role. Most of these cases, not all necessarily, cases of hermaphrodites, androgyny, ambiguous genitalia, we're dealing with male chromosomes rather than female chromosomes. But that's not dispositive by any means, nor does Rabbi Woldenberg claim they are. In the case that he was discussing, this baby had female genitalia. However, in the labia, there was a single testy. And the issue was, is this a male or a female? Is it an androgynous? And what do we do about the testy? Rabbi Woldenberg says that this is a female, and there's no reason for me to disagree. He has all the external organs of a female. The only problem here is the testy. I'm not sure by any means that the presence of a single testy is enough to establish that we're dealing with a androgynous. Rabbi Woldenberg thinks that we are not. It was also, I presume, although it's not clearly stated, a malformed testy. And his conclusion is that you can remove the testy and there's no iser of serus. The reasons that he permits this are not terribly much concern to us. In effect, he's saying it's not a real testy, so the rest is superfluous. He seems to think that even if it is a real testy, for technical reasons that we won't talk about, there won't be an iser of serus. He also talks about an androgynous who does present more of the external genitalia of both sexes, and he is also willing to permit the surgery to remove the testes if, and he emphasizes, if as a result of the procedure that will be performed, the child will be nishtane be'emes l'nekevo vadois. Now, I don't really know what that means. If he means in terms of external genitalia, I know what it means. And in effect, what he's saying is that these testes are not really testes, and if they are, it doesn't make any difference because they're never going to produce sperm. He will never be able to sire a child, and therefore there's no iser serus. What he means by whether it will be a real female, if he means in terms of external organs, I understand. If he means in terms of internal organs, there is no way that you can turn a male into a real female. You can turn him into a pseudo-female, but onto a real female.
So, Rabbi Blatt, continue, yeah.
Again, so that what he says in Yud Aleph is really not sex change, but
I understand.
With ambiguous genitalia. Now, the really troublesome tshuva is the one in Chelik Chof Beis. There, again, there is a fuller citation of the Yad Nemon and a few cryptic lines at the very end in which he talks about an androgynous and whether indeed it is permissible to turn what was earlier an androgynous or a tumtum into a female. Now, he seems to indicate that it is permissible to do that. Some people quote Rabbi Woldenberg, and in light of what he said in Chelik Yud, he was addressing only a natural metamorphosis or transformation from female to male and doesn't apply to sex change operations. Well, they think he's describing masinism, which is how we would describe what he is talking about in Chelik Yud. It seems to me that all that he's saying is a repetition of the things that he tried to establish in the earlier tshuva in Chelik Yud Aleph, that there are some cases in which removal of testes is not serus. And if you're dealing with someone who is, in brackets, he says, a tumtum, which means we have no real external genitalia, or an androgynous, and I presume he means an androgynous whose testes aren't real testes, and therefore he permits removing them. So it seems to me that Rabbi Woldenberg cannot be cited as sanctioning either sex change operations or as confirming the notion that if you have engaged in the sex change operation, you have effected a real change in terms of halacha. Now,
Rabbi Woldenberg, I'm sorry, Rabbi Blech, can I So your feeling as then comes out is that it's really it's more of a social issue than a halachic issue, and halachically we just do not recognize it. And the citations of Rabbi Waldenberg are basically incorrect because
correct.
Of this. Okay. Correct. So somebody walks into your shul, what do? Where do you put them?
When someone walks into my shul, there's several things I have to do. Number one, I have to make sure I'm not dealing with a case of ambiguous genitalia. There is a very remarkable tshuva in the Yavetz, in which he describes something that happened in Altona. A baby apparently was born. They didn't know whether there was a male organ in an orla or whether this was a female organ. And the rov at the time was Rabbi Chesko Katzenellenbogen. He paskened lahalocha that it was a male, insisted that the milah take place in the big shul, and the Yavetz disagreed with him very, very.
Where is this? Can you give us a citation if we want to look it up afterwards?
It's the Shilas Yavetz. It's Simen Kuf Ayin Aleph. He claims that this was a female. In fact, in the end of the shuvah, he says he wants to be Mefarsim. This person apparently was living in Altona. His name at the bris was Yosef ben Kalman, and he wants people to know that Yosef ben Kalman is not a male. Yosef ben Kalman is a female. And he says they gave him the wrong name. Instead of calling him Yosef, they should have called him Lo Yosef. They shouldn't have any more cases like this. Now, the person who walks in and says, I am a female, but I'm just walking around the male body, well, the first thing that has to be determined is, and what are the this external sexual organs? Does he have the sexual organs of a male or a female? Is he perhaps an androgynous in terms of halacha? Once you have determined that he is what the psychiatrist would call a true transgender, I can only tell him that what you're being asked to, or what's being proposed, is hormone therapy so that you will have the secondary characteristics of the gender with which you identify, that's absolutely usur in halacha, that's a form of lisilbosh. If a male is prohibited from plucking white hairs from his beard because that's something which he is doing to emulate considerations of feminine pulchritude, beautifying oneself in the manner of females is prohibited, certainly adorning oneself with secondary sexual characteristics of a female is in the category of lisilbosh. This happens as a result of hormone treatments. All of this is basically a hormonal imbalance. Again, I'm not sure about the person who identifies as transgender. Surgery is also not permissible. If you're dealing with a male who wants to become a female, you're dealing with actual sirus. This is castration. It's prohibited. In the case of a female, you're dealing with female sirus, which is at least an issur d'rabbanan. The Gra maintains it's also an issur d'oraisa. It involves removing internal sexual organs, and that's certainly not permissible, so that the procedures certainly cannot be permitted. And after the change has taken place, not only do I have no source that says that when it happens in surgery it makes any difference, other than the Psalmim Reish, who is discussing only the question of whether the female requires a get, I don't know of anyone who says that has any effect. It's interesting. The Yad Ne'eman talks about the Birkas HaShachar. What bracha should this person make? And there, that's why I'm absolutely certain he's not talking about surgery. He suggests that this person should make the bracha shehafchani kiritzoinai, not shehafchani kiritzoinai, but he changed me kiritzoinai. Now, if it's a surgical procedure, you don't say the Rabbeinu Shalom changed it. You did it yourself. But now we're dealing post-factum, and I don't think there is any change whatsoever. The real problem, and this is, forget about the transgender bathroom, that's a matter of tznius. And if you're telling me that this is a male who is dressing like a female and wants to use the bathroom, this is the Gemara that says that he shouldn't dress like a female and be a hulech bein hanoshim, for obvious reasons. That is the Isser of Leisulbish, according to the Rabbonin, of Reb Elezer ben Yanki that is in the Braise. So, of course, he shouldn't be a Hoylech Bein Hanoshim. I think that would be absolutely Osir. This person, Halocha, remains what he was previously.
So you want, but doesn't it present the problem to send somebody who's substantially a male into the Ezra's Nashim, or vice versa?
Again, first question is, how should the person dress? Now, it seems to me that since there's been no change, the person is still bound to wear the clothing of the gender in which he was born, and hence to sit on the side of the mechitza of the gender in which he was born. Now, the author of this little monograph, Tor Tapuchis, has a different position. I beg to differ, and differ very, very strongly. Number one, if in halacha no change has taken place, then this is a male, it's a female, whatever it was before. I am not aware of any source, and maybe somebody will have a source, in which case I will have to look into it. I am not aware that a soris who has been castrated and can no longer function as a male is permitted to wear female clothing. What we are dealing with here is a soris. He's a male who's been castrated. I don't know of any source that says that he's permitted to wear female clothing because, after all, he cannot consort with a female. Therefore, what do we care if he's a Hoylech Bein Hanoshim? Let's just take it to its logical conclusion. If a person comes into shul and is known publicly as a male and says, I am now wearing a dress, I would ask him, please leave. For the same, nobody examines the tzitzis if somebody comes into shul. However, if someone comes into shul and sits on smoking a cigarette in the corridor, I'm sure he'll be asked to leave. If you have a zohar who comes dressed in a dress, I think he should be asked to leave the shul. And to come back wearing appropriate clothing, and if we're dealing with a male, to sit on the men's side and not on the women's side. Okay. I don't think he should be permitted to sit on the women's side, and as a male, he should be sitting in the men's side, dressed in a suit and not in female clothing.
Experts on fertility, Rabbi Yehuda David Bleich, it's been a great honor to have you on with us.
Thank you very much.
We have on the phone with us, from Eretz Yisrael, from Beit Shemesh, Rabbi Yeshua Berman. He's a Rosh Kollel in Reshet Hadaf in Beit Shemesh. He's a Talmud of the Mir and Toras Moshe. He's a author of a number of Sfarim, most recently about Rabbi Twersky Hashem Yakam Damei. And for the purposes of this program, he's the Director of Prevention of Maneh of Beit Shemesh. Welcome, Rabbi Berman.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Rabbi Berman, could you tell us what you do and what your organization does?
Well, I'll start with the organization, and then I'll go from there to what I do. The organization basically deals primarily with child sexual abuse in the Frum community. For the time being, it's limited to Beit Shemesh, just because that's what resources allow, although we have had discussions about expanding to Yerushalayim. And, as a nisbach, we wind up dealing with a lot of other emotional issues that come up in families, all different types of traumatic things for which children need help with. But it was primarily set up and primarily deals with child sexual abuse. Now, within
Rabbi Berman, to give us a sense of perspective, how common is that?
Well, it's actually interesting that you ask, because we just now have begun a comprehensive case study review of the hundreds of cases that we have taken on over the past 5-some-odd years. And I would say close to, we can't give any conclusive numbers yet, but close to 50% of what we deal with is child sexual abuse. So it seems like it's not happening, to every other child, but the opinion that we've heard from people all over the world, in the research that I've done for the upcoming Dialogue magazine article, is that, the numbers seem to be anywhere between 1 in 10, 1 in 20, and of very, varying levels of severity.
So from 5 to 10% of children, you say, get abused.
Listen, there's no conclusive studies that have been done on the Frum Olam by itself. We're still waiting for that day to come, and maybe one day what we're doing now in Maneh will help towards that direction. But from an empirical, let's put it that way, from an empirical point of view, it would seem, what number did you just say, 5%?
1 in 10 would be 10%.
Yeah, so something like that. That's what the numbers seem like. I mean, in the general world, that they tack the numbers at about 1 in 10, and most from therapists, experts, etc., say that based on their experience, their clinical experience, it seems like our numbers are more or less the same. You know, there are others that say, no, it's less, but there really are no hard data studies that can say one way or the other.
Are there any other organizations in Eretz Yisrael that do what you do, that specialize in this?
Well, yes and no. I say yes because there are other organizations that their target is child sexual abuse, but in terms of successfully engaging the Haredi community on a broad level, there basically is no other organization, at least not that we're aware of. And, you know, we've done our homework, so that pretty much speaks for it. And what I could tell you is that in June, we had a visit from the Vadat HaKnesset, the Knesset Committee for Zchuyot HaYeled, which basically means children's rights. And they were very, very impressed by what's going on at Maneh. And the chairwoman of the community, her name is Dr. Yifat Shasha Biton, she wrote a letter to numerous Chavrei Knesset members, where she said that this model of Maneh seriously needs to be adopted throughout the country. So that would seem to underscore what our impression is, that this model does not exist. It's a very unique model.
Now, Rabbi Berman, and I know I'm asking somewhat vague questions, but can you give us a profile of the perpetrators, given that you've done hundreds of cases? Give us like a few of the profiles. Like,
sure, I can absolutely give you a few of the profiles. And again, the numbers that I'm going to give you, I can't say they're conclusive because this is the beginning of a major comprehensive case study review, but I can tell you what is so far the indicated results, not conclusive results. More than 60% of perpetrators are minors, not adults. Minors. More than 20% are siblings. Again, I want to emphasize these are not conclusive numbers. These are so far indicated. More than 20% are siblings. More than 35% are peers, meaning friends in school, in the park. More than 50% are 14 years old and under. Less than 8% are strangers. Now, when I say a stranger, I mean someone that is not within the kid's, you know, social circle. It's not a parent. It's not a relative. It's someone just, you know, that lured the kid in and really had nothing to do with the kid's life. That's less than 8%. Teachers don't even reach 1%. And more than 25% are 9 and under. It's actually startling to find how many cases of sexual impropriety slash abuse, and the reason why I say impropriety slash abuse is that generally we don't define it as, you know, from a legal perspective at least, sexual abuse, unless there's about a 3-year age gap or there was, you know, force being used in the act. But if the ages are very close and there wasn't force, then we call that sexual impropriety. Now, that doesn't mean that it can't have similar traumatic effects on the kid, because as, you know, numerous professionals and doctors point out, one of the major reasons why sexual abuse has such an effect on a kid is because he's developmentally totally unprepared for it. But, you know, those are basically the numbers, and, you know, you could figure out based on that, that within a prevention plan, you know, that's really my area, and the reason why I'm so interested in all of this information is that if you're going to make a prevention plan, it needs to be targeted because you want it to be effective.
Question. I'm not sure if you would have data or have studied this. What percentage of children who come forward with a complaint are making it up? Is it a fictitious thing?
You know, it's interesting that you asked me that because I really did do my homework on that one as well. Every single expert that my Rebbe, Rav Aaron Lopiansky, who I'm assisting him in preparing this article for Dialogue Magazine, interviewed, and every single one that I interviewed, insist that there are so few cases of fabricated claims that it's almost just irrelevant. However, I am going to note that, you know, by my nature, I'm someone that does my homework. And I looked up the sources, which is basically, you know, there's government massive databases. They put out a review every couple of years or so. And I looked up those sources myself. I don't have a background in, you know, in research, but I'm willing to quote chapter and verse for anybody who's actually interested, that there was in 2012, there was something like 3 million reports nationwide in the U.S. Out of those 3-some-odd million reports, about 12,000 were made by the alleged victim themselves, meaning it wasn't a report made by a teacher, it wasn't a report made by a parent. The alleged victim themselves made the report. And of those 12,000, about 80%, the investigation resulted in a conclusion of unsubstantiated. Now, does that mean that they lied? No, it doesn't mean that they lied, because there's no way to say that just because the investigators were not able to conclusively say that, oh, it's for real, that doesn't mean that the person lied. However, at the same time, it definitely, you know, is enough to raise an eyebrow or two and wonder why are so many reports coming up with an investigative conclusion of unsubstantiated, of non-victim. So, you know,
Rabbi Yvonne, so what are your, when do you report to the police and when don't you? What's your process?
Well, the process within Maneh follows the law. Whenever the law demands a report, then the report is made. When the law does not demand a report, so then it's dealt with on a case-by-case basis. Because something which is very important to understand, and this has, you know, this has support both in research as well as, you know, empirical experience, is that a knee-jerk reaction of making a report is not necessarily always the best way to deal with things. For example, we spoke to Rav Zev Cohen from the Chicago Beis Din, and he gave an example of a case which was the worst type of abuse imaginable and the best type of testimony and evidence available. And instead of going, having involvement with the Beis Din, the people involved went straight to the police, and he said that he's not sure if the perpetrator spent even one night in jail. Now, why is that? Go figure. I can tell you there was a case that Maneh dealt with not so long ago. A father was severely, severely abusing his daughter. Okay, it's the worst form of abuse imaginable, sexual abuse imaginable. Okay, and the mother at some point realized what was going on. She contacted Maneh. Of course, we made an appropriate report. For whatever reason, and we don't know why, the police were dragging their feet, and they did not do anything about it. You know, it was unfathomable to us, but sometimes the police don't explain to us why they do what they do or why they don't do what they don't do. So, you know, the director of Maneh, whose name is Rabbi Ari Levy, he felt, okay, this girl is, you know, she's getting literally raped by her father on a regular basis. He's got to try to do something to help her. So he called a bluff. He called this guy up and he said, "Hello, Mr. So-and-so, you don't know who I am, but my name is Rabbi Ari Levy, and I want you to know that we know what you're doing, and you may not take one more step into your house, and if you do, I can't promise you, but in all likelihood, the next day you'll be taken away in handcuffs." Baruch Hashem, the ruse worked, and he escaped. He went to his parents' house in Bnei Brak. 3 months later, I kid you not, a full 3 months later, the guy was still hanging out in his parents' house in Bnei Brak. At least Baruch Hashem, he wasn't abusing his daughter. We had a meeting with the police chief here in Beit Shemesh to talk about a number of things. And one of the things that we said to them is that how could it be that Maneh, that has absolutely no legal, you know, backing to be able to do something, has managed to keep this girl protected from her father for 3 months, and you guys are doing nothing? So Baruch Hashem, today, the guy is sitting in jail. You know, but this type of interaction between a internal communal organization, whether it be a Beis Din or an organization like Maneh, and the authorities, at least from, you know, Rabbi Zev Cohen's perspective, and for sure from our perspective, is critical to how to deal with these issues. And that's why, when the law requires it, of course, you know, we make the reports according to the law's requirement, because
but
you can't
what do
run
you do with the halachic? What do you do with the halachic requirements? Let's say, you know, the halacha may have different requirements than the law. How do you balance that?
The halachic requirements that, first of all, let me point something out. Mane was initiated by the Rabbanim here in Ramat Beit Shemesh. It was not created by Askanim who decided to take matters into their own hands. The Rabbanim are the ones who decided that this issue can no longer go being not dealt with in a comprehensive, professional, proper manner. And they were the ones who activated the, you know, major communal Askanim over here and said, you've got to set something up. And the Rabbanim give guidance constantly. So Mane is very patient for it, of why this is so important. We had a case of, I mean, it was horrendous. A kid was abusing himself. This was like a 7, 8, 9-year-old kid. And he, when we got to him, he was talking about how within the whole class, okay, and this is talking about a cheder, a really from cheder, within the whole class, the topic of sex was a discussed topic. It was something talked about, and there was basically a pyramid of sexual activity going on between the boys in this class. Now, when the parents came to us, they were adamant, we don't want any outside involvement whatsoever. That means no police, no revacha, no nothing. But because we have an organization like Mane, where it's run by Haredi people, it has Rabbanim behind it and guiding it, we were able to deal with them. We were able to explain to them the situation, and we were able to tell them and explain to them in a way that they were eventually able to accept that it's important that we make a report. And we explained it to them, and they accepted it. They were makabel. This was a situation that if not for an organization like Manet, this situation would have just continued. It would have been perpetuated. You know, and you could just imagine how many ripple effects that could have to so many future children. And because they came to Manet, it was able to be dealt with.
So do you feel that you've saved many children's lives?
Let me put it this way. I feel that Mane has definitely saved many children's lives. However, the amount of work that needs to be done, at least from my point of view, a prevention point of view, is so much more. Because to really get at this problem at its core, you need to educate. You need to educate parents, you need to educate teachers, and you need to educate children. And in order to do that, especially within the Haredi community, you have to first of all figure out how you are going to target that education. And then you have to figure out how you are going to get it across in a way that it will be accepted. So we're doing that. We do it quietly. We don't come out, you know, with big posters, and we don't make a lot of noise, because the Haredi community here in Eretz Yisrael is very, very, as sensitive as they are in America, it's much, much more so over here. So my feeling is that as much as we've done, there is still so much more to do, because we don't want to just help situations that are already in a terrible state. We want to try to get it where parents know how to protect their children. Children, at least to whatever extent they're able, know how to protect themselves. Teachers know how to identify when problems might be coming up, and so on and so forth. And that's a tremendous, tremendous amount of work. And the bulk of that work still stands before us.
And what would you say? You say you were appalled. What would you say to, you know, the Kanoim, the Abba Hershkowitzes, or Maya Reuven Berkowitzes of the world, who, when people report to the police, they actually attack the victim's parents, etc.? What would you tell them?
I would tell them the same thing that Dr. Shani Verschleiser of Magenu says. She writes in her material, I think very aptly, that if you believe someone, there's nothing wrong with supporting them. However, that's a far cry from going and victimizing an alleged victim. You can support someone morally. You can even support someone financially if you believe them. But to then go ahead and assume that the alleged perpetrator is really the victim, and the alleged victim is really the perpetrator, that's totally out of line. And you really need to stay out of it. You know, Dr. Shlomi Zimmerman, he's on the board of Amudim. He also said very, very well. He said, bringing something to the authorities is not an indication that we're assuming that someone is guilty. What it means is that there are people that are professionally trained to investigate accusations, and let's let them do their job. Because if we let them do their job, then we have the best chance at coming to a clarification of what's going on. So you want to believe someone, you want to support someone, that's fine. But don't start making problems by victimizing an alleged victim. Let the people that are professionally trained to investigate do their job.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Berman. It's been an honor to have. The Shabbat Shalom should give you kayach to continue doing your hatzalas nefashis.
Amen. Thank you very much.
Kol tov. Bye-bye.
Bye.